You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 13th of January 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, the UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson apologises for attending the Downing Street Garden Party, but says he thought it was a work event.
I have learned enough to know that there were things we simply did not get right. And I must take responsibility.
We'll ask Monocle 24's Westminster watcher Vincent McAvaney whether Johnson's apology will be enough for him to keep his job. Also coming up, as the Iranian foreign minister heads to Beijing, we'll explore his country's even closer ties with the Chinese leadership. A bit later on today's show, how Austria's far left is redefining the political landscape in one of the country's most important cities.
The Communist Party of Austria is one of the oldest in the world, founded in 1918, and it was the only party that survived Nazi dictatorship, and we take some pride in that.
Plus, the day's papers and Matt Wolfe from the New York Times will be here to give us the latest headlines from the world of theatre. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. The US Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, has warned Russia that it must choose either diplomacy or confrontation with the West. A sample collected by China's Chang'e 5 space rover has revealed the first ever physical evidence of water on the moon. And Ronnie Spector, the lead singer of the 1960s pop group The Ronettes, has died at the age of 78. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has finally apologised. During Prime Minister's question time in Westminster yesterday, he said he was sorry for breaking COVID lockdown rules by attending a party at Downing Street. Let's have a listen.
Mr. Speaker, I want to apologise. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months. I know the anguish that they have been through, unable to mourn their relatives, unable to live their lives as they want, or to do the things they love. And I know the rage they feel with me and with the government I lead when they think that in Downing Street itself, the rules are not being properly followed by the people who make the rules. And though I cannot anticipate the conclusions of the current inquiry, I have learned enough to know that there were things we simply did not get right. And I must take responsibility. Number 10 is a big department with the garden as an extension of the office, which has been in constant use because of the role of fresh air in stopping the virus. And when I went into that garden just after 6 on the 20th of May 2020, to thank groups of staff before going back into my office 25 minutes later to continue working, I believed implicitly that this was a work event. But Mr. Speaker, with hindsight, I should have sent everyone back inside. I should have found some other way to thank them. And I should have recognised that even if it could be said technically to fall within the guidance, there would be millions and millions of people who simply would not see it that way. People who suffered terribly. People who were forbidden from meeting loved ones at all, inside or outside. And to them and to this House, I offer my heartfelt apologies. And all I ask is that Sue Gray be allowed to complete her inquiry into that day and several others so that the full facts can be established. And I would, of course, come back to this House and make a statement.
That's the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the House of Commons yesterday. Well, Vincent McAvin, he's a political reporter and our Monocle 24's Westminster watcher. My heartfelt apologies, he said. Well, there are many in this country who feel that he really didn't say sorry. What's been said?
Well, that was a very different tone from any that we've heard from Boris Johnson before in the House of Commons, trying to sound somewhat contritious. He was giving that apology, but it was very much a legal apology. It was putting in that caveat that he believes that the garden of number 10 Downing Street, his office and his home, is part of the workspace. That is something that had been carefully worked out so that the Prime Minister still wants to have this wiggle room so that he can get out of possibly having broken the restrictions. And we're already, you know, now 2 weeks into the new year, and we have a breakout star, Sue Gray. She's the name on everyone's lips. He mentioned Sue Gray more than a dozen times, I think, because any question about this, Prime Minister's questions and the day before when he was interviewed, was being battered away by Sue Gray. And now all eyes are on her to deliver a report.
So she is the civil servant, the top civil servant who has been tasked with doing this. And she is the reason that he's able to say, I can't answer these questions. So who is she? And is she likely to be tough on him? Because history shows that generally civil servants are investigating prime ministerial malfunctions, if you like, have let them off.
Well, she is a senior civil servant. She's worked across multiple departments. And there's, in fact, a story from the Cameron Osborne years that when they were first getting to grips with cabinet, when they were talking about their plans, and they talked about some ideas that they had in the initial few weeks, Sue Gray was a voice who stood up and said, oh, Prime Minister, you can't do that. She is someone who knows, because she used to sit in this ethics office within the cabinet office, what can and can't be done. So she is someone who has been, you know, praised across the board from MPs as someone in Whitehall who gets things done. But let's look at what she's got to investigate. You know, this isn't like previous investigations into prime ministerial conduct into, say, the Iraq war and intelligence failures. This is a very simple thing. Was there a party in the garden? Who set it out? Did the prime minister attend? Did it break the rules? It's not, you know, we're not hunting for WMDs in Iraq here. This is a very simple tale. And there's CCTV all over that building. There are police officers who they can ask. There is a log of all the things, all the comings and goings in that building that they can dive into. But what is her report actually going to be? Because actually, in some ways, the more that it's talked about, the more it's built up as this all-powerful thing. But actually, is she just going to set out a clear timeline of what's happened on her investigation and then just leave it for MPs to deal with? Because, as you say, you don't want to be a civil servant who removes the Prime Minister. And I think we would all be a little bit uncomfortable maybe if just one person had the power to do that. But is it going to trigger the necessary dozens of letters to the 1922 committee to actually remove Boris Johnson from office? And there does seem to be some MPs who are feeling that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the MPs are really the people who have the final decision, because even if the country wants him to go, he can only be removed by the Conservative Party. But there is a huge amount of public anger. How much agency does the British population have? Do we just have to wait for the next election?
Well, I'd say on the first part, yeah, the anger is interesting, because there are those former allies of Boris Johnson, people that wanted him in, who have now turned against him. You've had two select committee chairs, Will Ragg and Caroline Noakes, who are both Conservative in the past 24 hours, saying that he should go. The leader in Scotland, Douglas Ross, saying that he should go, along with many of the MSPs up there. So there is strong anger in the party, and I think part of that comes from the blowback from the public that they're feeling on the fact that there was a breaking of rules. The general public feel like they set the rules, they broke them, he's not showing contrition, he laughed in that interview at them on Tuesday, and they're very angry about it. But on top of that as well, you've got local Conservative associations, which tend to be quite libertarian in their Conservative views, who have been very reluctant with lockdown measures anyway. And they, going into this year, thought Downing Street that, OK, we haven't gone into another lockdown. We've managed to just kind of scrape by with Plan B and Omicron. we'll win back favour of the ranks now because we've, you know, whilst other nations are going back into lockdowns in Europe, we're avoiding that. But this has undone all of that progress that they were hoping. This was meant to be their reset week. They started it with a big revival of their cladding policy, which actually was a decent attempt to fix it. And all of that's gone now.
Yeah. The leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, was very, very strong in his calls for Johnson to resign. But I wonder if it would actually be to the opposition's advantage if he stays in place until the next election, when the country may well punish him by voting Labour.
That might be part of their calculation. It was interesting yesterday that Keir Starmer, who's a very careful, considered person, actually did call for Boris Johnson to finally go and push that hard at Prime Minister's questions and on social media. I think, though, in Labour's mind, yes, you might not want to get someone in like a Liz Truss or a Rishi Sunak now, who could have a bit of a bounce because they're a new leader, give them time to refresh. You also, that person, they would then face the decision that prime ministers do when they get in, like Boris Johnson did, like Gordon Brown. Would you perhaps call a fresh election when you've got a bit of a honeymoon period, say, initially, and try and give yourself a proper term? Or do you just ride it out until 2024? Where do you hedge your bets on that? So Labour, I think, will be hoping that Boris Johnson does stay because, yes, he has become at the levels of unpopularity that Theresa May was at the end of her premiership. But at the same time, we're still possibly 2 years away from a general election, 2.5 at the very most. So it is a difficult balance for them to do.
Vinny, this is a man, our Prime Minister, is a man who has been sacked from every job he had for lying.
Apart from the Mayor of London, that's the only one that he wasn't sacked for. When he was at the Times, his first job as a journalist, he made up quotes, essentially lying. That is the highest crime in journalism to do. He was sacked from that. He was sacked from his first cabinet position under the then leader, Michael Howard, because he lied about an affair that came out. So he is someone. And I think what's interesting about this whole episode and the anger it stoked and why his polling personally has plummeted and he's dragged his party down is that we use this expression, I've used it in the studio with you about Boris Johnson, that was for a party that for much of its recent times has been a party of family values, it claimed. And it was all about, you know, it was all about the kind of family, basically, and still in the past decade introducing family tax breaks. It was always very strange that Boris Johnson, who has a very, let's say, colourful personal life, was so willingly accepted as their leader. And we've seen, you know, we've had a prime minister, even in the time that he's become prime minister, he's divorced one wife, he's married another, he's had yet more children. What the phrase that was being used was that it was all baked into Boris Johnson. Everyone knew who he was because he'd been on the scene for so long. But I think part of that baking in was, yeah, but he's never going to betray me. Whereas what's happened here, I think the whole country feels like a personal betrayal because it was such a universal experience. You're just hearing dozens and dozens of horrendous stories of people who lost siblings, parents, children during that first lockdown when the death count was so high, who obeyed the rules to the point where they were not by them on their bedsides as they died. They were on the ends of iPhones if they were lucky to them. That's why I think the anger is so strong.
Can he survive this?
Well, I think you have to look at what the manoeuvres were. So the Conservative Party is good at getting rid of leaders. They got rid of IDS, of Margaret Thatcher. They got rid of David Cameron in the end. They got rid of Theresa May. I think what you have to watch is the runners and riders. And the front two are Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. And I think yesterday, Boris Johnson, after PMQs, went into the tea rooms trying to lobby the ranks. There was a slow drip, drip, drip of the cabinet coming out supporting him, either on the airwaves or via tweets. But the two that I think are most interesting, and they were the latest in the day. So you got Rishi Sunak, who said, and I quote on the tweet, "I've been on a visit all day today, continuing work on our hashtag plan for jobs, as well as meeting MPs to discuss the energy situation. The PM was right to apologise, and I support his request for patience while Sue Gray carries out her inquiry." not exactly a willing, you know, endorsement there, is it? He was saying, oh, I've been really busy looking at jobs. Have you? Which job exactly, Mr. Rishi, have you been looking at? And then backing the inquiry. So that went out about 10 past 8 last night. And then Liz Truss, who's the other big runner at the moment, at 9:15. The Prime Minister is delivering for Britain, from Brexit to the booster programme to the economic growth. I stand behind the Prime Minister 100% as he takes our country forward. Now, there used to be a joke in Westminster that when the Prime Minister would back someone 100%, that was normally on day 5 of a scandal, and by day 6 they were gone. So those are the two that are worth watching at the moment. They obviously publicly at the moment are still sounding like they don't feel that he's quite injured enough that they can make their move. They're probably thinking, wait until the report comes out and then see what happens. And in the meantime, try and work MPs and see if you can build enough support if there was to be a runoff leadership election.
Vincent, thank you. I'm quite sure we'll be returning to this story.
Oh, yeah.
That was Vincent McAvinney, and you're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. In March last year, China and Iran signed a comprehensive strategic partnership in order to boost economic and political relations. This week, Iran's foreign minister is visiting Beijing to discuss the 25-year cooperation agreement. Well, Sanam Vakil is the deputy director of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House and an expert on Iran, and joins me now. Sanam, thank you very much for coming on to The Globalist again. What is the history of the relationship between these two countries, Iran and China?
Thank you for having me. Well, the relationship between the two go back a number of decades. China has been an influential supporter of the Islamic Republic of Iran since the revolution, helped Iran with its nuclear program, and the two have forged very important economic ties over the years that have helped Iran weather sanctions and pressure from the United States.
And can you give us more detail on this strategic partnership?
This is a document that was released last year, as you mentioned it. It's a 25-year agreement. I see it more of as a memorandum of understanding, where both sides would commit to develop stronger economic relations. And I think the number associated with the partnership is $400 billion. But it's important because Iran has been under very extreme sanctions after U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear agreement. And Iran, because of the U.S. withdrawal, has experienced significant sanctions, hasn't been able to export oil at the capability that it would like. And China has represented an important trading partner, and the document would commit China over a long period of time, 25 years, to invest more readily in the Iranian economy, regardless of what happens with the United States or the nuclear agreement.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the nuclear agreement, because, of course, right now, talks between Iran and major powers are ongoing in Vienna. So, I mean, given that, how significant is the foreign minister's visit?
It's significant because China is, again, an important political player for Iran. China sort of backs the Iranian position and understands or has empathy towards Iran, particularly after the U.S. Withdrawal. But at the same time, China would like to see the Iran nuclear agreement resurrected. And so it has pushed Iran, nudged Iran forward to make concessions. And China is playing an important supportive role in these negotiations. Mm.
And in terms of this ministerial visit to Beijing, do we know what's on the agenda?
Well, the 25-year partnership, I suppose, ironing out the details, which many of them we don't know. The Chinese have committed to opening a consulate on the Persian Gulf in Bandar Abbas, and China, I think, will be investing in infrastructure projects, which have been important in the past and will be important going forward as the Iranian government is looking for funding and investment to diversify its economy even further. So, I think this will be the crux of of the agreement. But at the same time, Iran has joined the Shanghai Cooperation Council, which is an Eastern-oriented body, defense and security body. China, Iran would like to strengthen its ties with Asian states to balance against the pressure it receives from the United States and European countries.
Mm. And just before we go, I see that a British Council employee who was arrested in Iran has been let go. And I wonder if this is indicative of perhaps a softening of the regime, and if indeed Nazanin Haddari Ratcliffe might be released too.
Well, I think that the intention is to release all of the dual nationals that have been held hostage in Iran. And the case of Aras Amiri is an important one. It's great that she's back in the UK. I think the broader objective is to release all of the British dual nationals, and probably it will be tied to any accomplishment made in Vienna. And maybe part of a bigger release that would include American hostages as well.
Sanam, thank you very much indeed. That was Sanam Vakil from Chatham House. Now, still to come, we review the day's newspapers. Matt Wolfe unpacks the biggest stories in the world of theatre. And then...
The Communist Party of Austria is one of the oldest in the world, founded in 1918. And it was the only party that survived Nazi dictatorship, and we take some pride in that.
We'll find out why Austria's far left is enjoying a resurgence. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Yesterday, a poll showed that Valérie Pécresse, the French conservative right-wing politician, has drawn level with President Emmanuel Macron in the second round of the 2022 presidential election. So, who is she, and does she have a realistic shot at being the next leader of France? Well, Florence Biedermann, AFP journalist in Paris, joins me now to profile Pécresse. Florence, lovely to talk to you again. What is Valérie Pécresse's personal background?
Well, she comes from a pretty well-heeled family from Neuilly, and she had these brilliant studies, like she was in this National School of Administration, then High School for Commerce. So she has this pretty traditional, let's say, and so strong background study-wise. Then she was close to President Chirac. She has this also, let's say, Catholic upbringing, a bit traditional. So she became an advisor to Chirac. And then for years, she was a minister under Sarkozy for higher education, where she implemented one of the few reforms that were really successful under Sarkozy. So she's kind of an achiever. And now for years, she has been an MP and also the president of the Regional Council of Île-de-France. This is the area around Paris, mm-hmm. where she has been doing pretty well with in the way she managed the region. She has been recently re-elected.
What issues does she support?
Let's say inside the Republican Party, which is this traditional right, she's rather like a centrist. But economically, she has this classic liberal values, you could say, just like Macron, like reducing budget deficit, putting order in the accounts, having kind of a budget orthodoxy, and then also decreasing tax on companies, like to push investment. So she would have that traditional liberal policy. On social matters, she would be a bit more conservative. Like, let's say she was, for example, against gay marriage, and she was even campaigning against it at one point. So now, in her program, she has to toughen her stance somehow because, as you know, there is now a newcomer in the presidential race who is Éric Zemmour, a pretty extreme right polemicist. So. Who managed to split the vote for Marine Le Pen. So let's say this trend toward extreme right ideas in the campaign has also made her speak more in a tougher way on immigration, like she wants to impose quota. She doesn't want to grant anymore the right to be a French citizen when you're born in the country, if you have foreign origin. So she has somehow been veering more to the right inside her party.
Mm. Why do you think that there's been a surge in her popularity now?
Well, because she looks like a kind of a hope for people who don't want Macron to become president again, because she is seen like more credible, for example, than Marine Le Pen or Éric Zemmour to run the country. She is part of this governmental party. She has been a minister. She knows the rules. So she seems to be more competent, more, let's say, at ease with that kind of questions. And this makes her really a very dangerous opponent for Macron because of her credibility. And that's why now probably she's reaching the same level as he does in the polls.
Mm. So do you think that she could conceivably win the election? And if she did, what would that mean for France and more widely Europe?
Yes, she could. She could win. I mean, definitely. Nobody really. I mean, you could think Marine Le Pen is too extreme to ever win a second round. But this is not the case of Valérie Pécresse. So definitely she could be the first woman president in France, which would be already something big for this country. For the rest of the world, I don't think it would change that much. She's like her party, pro-European, even if skeptical, you know. But she never spoke, you know, about leaving the euro, or she has, let's say, on foreign policy, she doesn't seem to have really very original views. Like it would be the same policy for France in the world, I would say. Mm-hmm. And for the country itself, well, what would be the difference? Definitely, there would be some changes in policies on immigration. That's there would be probably a toughening. But for the rest, for economics, you could tend to think it would be more or less the same program as Macron has, with some nuance, of course.
Mm. And finally, it's all over the papers today. This row about Molière, she's calling out Macron on this. Tell us more.
Well, I mean, she has been, trying to put Macron in a difficult place on several questions. So that would be one of those. I don't think he will really play a role in the race. But you know, it's kind of let's say cultural mini war. Like she said, oh, Macron ignores Molière too much. Like he's not this literate and traditional. Culturally traditional man, so that's the idea. Like just like years ago, Sarkozy had said, "What's the use of reading Princesse de Clèves?" And it was a polemic. So this is that kind of polemic in France, you know, on big authors where you try to use them to your advantage.
Florence, thank you very much indeed. That was AFP's Florence Biedermann in Paris. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. The US Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, has warned Russia that it must choose either diplomacy or confrontation with the West. She was speaking after talks between NATO and Russia, one of three diplomatic events this week aimed at reducing tension over Ukraine. A sample collected by China's Chang'e 5 space rover has revealed the first ever physical evidence of water on the moon. The discovery is likely to have massive implications for the future of space travel. You can find out more by heading to monocle.com/minute and signing up to our daily news bulletin. And Ronnie Spector, the lead singer of the 1960s pop group The Ronettes, has died at the age of 78. She rose to fame with hits such as Be My Baby, Baby I Love You and Walking in the Rain. The Ronettes are largely credited with paving the way for future female musical artists. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. The Austrian city of Graz has a new mayor, and it's a double first, a woman and a communist. Amidst the chaos of the country's national politics, Elke Kahr seems calm and collected. But more importantly, her policies and her ideas have been well received. She's already shelved the expensive prestige projects of the previous administration and reorganised the city's finances, freeing up money for welfare services, social housing and climate protection. So could communism be the answer to Austria's problems? Monocle's Alexei Kurilov sent us this report.
If we, unless we, make sure that there's no infiltration of our government, then just as certain as you sit there, you will see a red world.
This portrayal of communism as dark, evil, and malign was commonplace in 20th century Western culture. And even though those fears were massively exaggerated, Russian communism was evil. Its vision of a new and better society in Russia and elsewhere failed, and failed spectacularly. Because far from bringing freedom and prosperity to the people, it degenerated into dictatorship. Here in Central Europe, the word communism has long since fallen out of use. For some, it's a reminder of a painful past. For others, a convenient bogeyman.
My name is Elke Kahr. Since a short time, I'm the mayor from our city, Graz.
So when, a few months ago, Elke Kahr was elected mayor of Graz, Austria's second biggest city, it sent shockwaves across the country. Because Elke Kahr is a communist, and she was as surprised as anyone.
I was very surprised, der fast unglaublich ist. Aber dieses große Vertrauen, das die Bevölkerung in unserer Stadt uns gibt, das ist etwas, was schon seit Jahrzehnten ist.
But now, as her mayorship begins in earnest, she has her hands full.
And my job is the same than 30 years before. I try to stand by the people every day. Mm. And that's for me the important job.
She means this literally. Elke Kahr is remarkably approachable. Anyone can come and see her about their grievances. But her main concerns are rising inequality, rising rents, and rising energy bills. She's even promised to give 2/3 of her salary away to those in need. Communism has a long history in Austria.
The Communist Party of Austria is one of the oldest in the world, founded in 1918, and it was the only party that survived Nazi dictatorship, and we take some pride in that fact that we are the only party that couldn't be brought down by the National Socialists.
Georg Fuchs is one of Elke Kahr's closest aides, and himself a long-time member of the Austrian Communist Party, or KPÖ.
I joined in 1986 when I was 14, and I'm active ever since. I've been active ever since.
The communists have always been strong in Graz. And so, he says, their ascendancy is logical.
It was a bit like new hope to get a better administration. Mm. The old one had the reputation of making policies for rich people, for investment, and also for having a negative impact on the natural environment, for things like applying for Olympic Games, which wouldn't be affordable, and things like that. So
seriously, Olympic Games?
Yes.
In Graz?
Yes. But I think the foremost reason why people voted for KPÖ is just Elke Kahr and her. She's very approachable. She really stands out with this approach.
Elke Kahr has comrades in arms across Europe. The communist mayor of Grigny in France was even voted the world's best mayor by the World Mayor Foundation last year. But Graz is by far the largest city on the continent to be run by communists.
I know this, but it is not so important in the history, maybe. But ich bin keine große Freundin von Symboliken.
She's no friend of symbolism, she says. Her motto is, make the people around you happier, here and now, and the rest will follow. Will it? For Monocle in Graz, I'm Alexei Korodov.
Thanks very much to Alexei. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. And I'm joined in the studio by the political journalist and author Terry Stiastny. Terry, there's really one story here in Britain at the moment, but absolutely fascinating to look at how the different papers are reporting Boris Johnson's potential downfall.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we've got the, you know, the print editions of the papers here, and they're all reflecting that. And they've all got most of them have the face of a rather sort of hangdog Boris Johnson in the House of Commons. The Guardian has the Prime Minister, and they describe it as PM's future on knife edge after number 10 party apology. But I think one of the really fun things to go into in all of these is always the off the record quotes that people get from MPs. So again, you know, the Times says defiant PM refuses to quit as the polls slip further. I'm particularly going to draw out some of these folks. So interesting, in the Guardian, another MP said to the journalist, "I've not seen such a half-assed apology since my child apologised for spilling all the milk." And another article also in The Guardian, the MPs weighing up their options about what to do about the Prime Minister, whether they should get rid of him. Somebody saying, "Tory MPs will be thinking, before he was a helium balloon that was lifting the party, now he's an anchor dragging us down," said one senior Conservative. And interestingly, both The Times and The Financial Times seem to have spoken to similar people who are both saying that really, although Boris Johnson gave, you know, the sort of half-hearted apology that you've been hearing about already, as soon as he went into the House of Commons tea room at lunchtime immediately after, where the MPs go and gather and you normally go and try and persuade them round to your side, and the MPs said that Johnson was still in denial and with apologies for his language. Apparently, Boris Johnson, according to the Financial Times, told sullen Tory MPs, "Sorry for putting you through all this crap." And the Times and the FT have both had the same quote here, saying he said that sometimes in life you get the credit for things you don't deserve, while sometimes you get the blame for something you don't deserve too. And but the Tory MP goes on to tell the Financial Times he goes through his life thinking he doesn't deserve the blame. So it's just the difference between the sort of the public face and the semi kind of the semi private face here, but
because I mean, he really doesn't believe that he did anything wrong.
Well, I think it is. I'm sorry for getting caught, or I'm, you know, sort of sorry not sorry. But then the other thing that people are picking up on here, and again, the Daily Telegraph has sort of outlier of a headline here saying Sunak, as in Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, leaves Johnson in limbo, and they are pointing out the fact that the Chancellor Rishi Sunak gave, again, as about a half-hearted endorsement of the Prime Minister, as his apology was half-hearted, issuing a very carefully worded statement, which didn't come until, you know, late last night, that Rishi Sunak didn't go to the Commons and went to Devon on what his advisers said was a scheduled trip. And so they are really pointing out that what they see as the lack of support from the Chancellor. But again, many of the papers, there's a fantastic, I recommend this picture here in the Daily Telegraph, which has got sort of all of the Labour benches, all the MPs all masked, and just all of them pointing at Boris Johnson as he made his statement yesterday. But again, the Telegraph pointing out that, saying, predicting that MPs say Tory anger about the situation will just drag on, adding a year of agony is a high possibility, because they're suggesting that even you know, the people who might want to succeed the Prime Minister as leader probably don't want to do it immediately, with local elections looming and inflation and fuel prices rising and more problems coming down the track. You know, why would you want to take over at a point like this?
Poison chalice.
Well, speaking of poison chalice, here we have the sketch in the Telegraph talks about perhaps the poison plastic cup. Madeleine Grant says, "Yes, only our politicians could be brought so low by plastic cups and some tepid Pinot Grigio." So how typical that our politicians are brought low by these plastic cups, some tepid Pinot Grigio bought from the Westminster Tube Tesco, and a garden whose identity as a garden is itself a matter of debate.
Which is quite extraordinary. I mean, and Twitter has been hilarious about this too, and many people, and indeed some of the papers, have picked up on the fact that Donald Trump faces less pushback from his own party about organising an insurrection than Boris Johnson does for attending the party.
Yes, the whole question of the party that was possibly a work event has become, you know, the thing that's going around, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hilarious, but it shouldn't be. I mean, this is a very serious thing for the country. But in fact, Britain is doing what Britain does best, and that's making a joke of it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, although obviously, you know, again, and if you go through the papers, you will see numbers of people who are talking about, you know, the family that they lost, the people that they couldn't visit, the events that they couldn't go to at the same time that, you know, that Downing Street was having a party or possibly a large work event with lots of wine. You know, there is this tendency to make a joke of it as well. But I think most people will remember a lot of the serious part of this.
Mm. And I just wonder, looking at the role of the police here, because this is something we haven't gone into very much, but some of the papers are saying that the police are being very reluctant to investigate this because, of course, they themselves must be implicated in some way. The 10 Downing Street is absolutely guarded by police 24 hours a day. Did the police not notice there was a party going on?
Well, I think, yes. I mean, I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I think the Met did get in contact with the Cabinet Office and say that they were, you know, were certainly aware of this now. I think the idea of, you know, a lot of these were people who were working in Downing Street anyway. So, of course, you have to go through the police checkpoints to go in there. But once you're in there, you know, the police are really just sort of opening the doors and so forth. So, I'm not sure that that's something that, you know, we're going to hear so much about. But you see, certainly there were reports yesterday suggesting that this was a party that could be heard from outside the building and outside the area because it was out of doors. And if you remember how quiet London was at that time, you know, the idea that you could hear the sounds of any sort of party. And yes, there weren't many people around, but it's certainly, yes, as strange to say the least.
I remember at the time I felt that all I could hear was ambulances.
Yes, I remember that as well. That's one of the real memories of that time. Yeah.
And so eerie, isn't it, when you look back? And I, in common with many people, went and looked back at my diary to see exactly what I was doing at that time. And the answer was absolutely nothing. Certainly not going to parties. Let's go to France now. And this is a story that's been ongoing for several years now, an enduring mystery. Tell us about the Alps murder.
Yes, this is, again, this is, I think, 2012, so 10 years ago this year. And a family were, Saad al-Hilli, an Iraqi-born engineer who was British, his wife and her mother were killed in the village, near the village of Chevaline, near Lake Annecy. And the French call it the sort of the Affaire Chevaline. And it's interesting that so Libération is sort of describing how similar this case or seemed to be to some sort of, you know, police drama or true crime story. And they call it as fascinating as it is incredible. And over the years, you know, various people have been arrested. There's been all sorts of theories as to what might have happened, what the possible motives were for this killing. The family's children survived the attack and a cyclist was shot dead as well. But now, so The Guardian and other papers report that a man has been detained again in connection with the unsolved case of three British family members and a French cyclist who were shot dead at the time. And police sources told French media that an unidentified man had been taken into custody, his home searched. The man's movements and whereabouts on the day of the killings, as well as the days before and after, were being verified. And he's been arrested and he is going to be spoken to by Lynn Bonnet, the public prosecutor.
Let's just do full disclosure here. Lynn Bonnet, the prosecutor, is in fact my cousin.
Wow. So in this sort of spiral type story, we will be expecting to hear from you about the so it said that further details will be released after the detention. But of course, you know, in France, this is all, as you will no doubt know, these investigations covered by judicial secrecy laws. So you tend not to hear very much about the progress of a French case while the investigation is still going on. But yeah, I think this is just, you know, an endlessly fascinating story, and there's so many mysteries about it, so many claims about cover-ups and who was the real target and what was the real motive and was it money or was it family or was there some sort of grand espionage thing going on that we don't know about. So you know, everybody still speculates about this, but obviously, you know, there's the investigation is still continuing.
Absolutely, and I promise not to use family privilege to get inside the knowledge on that. Finally, let's go to the back of the FT.
Yes, this is a lovely story, and I think it's just something that we should notice more widely. It's just in the notebook column of the Financial Times, and it's by Sarah Ebner, and it's a very personal story about how she received received a brand new European passport, an Austrian passport, and she's saying how she now has the highly prized right of European citizenship because she still has her father's brown passport, Deutsches Reich, with a swastika bearing eagle, and his name, the name Israel, put next to her father's first name and surname, so it's showing that he was a Jew and that he had lost his Austrian citizenship. But he was lucky enough to escape from Vienna in 1939 and get to the UK with his parents. But because Austria changed the law in September 2019, the Austrian Parliament changed the law and it came into effect in September 2020. And it means that people like Sarah Ebner and her family were able to regain Austrian citizenship. And it's just a lovely article about how important that is. And she's saying that her father then in his 80s was keen to help and to get his grandchildren to regain the citizenship that had been taken away from them by force.
Absolutely. And frankly, at the moment, anything to be European and to distance oneself from what's going on in this country.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I think it's just really interesting seeing that she mentions here the political shift within Austria and the way that Austria is now, as somebody says here in this article, coming very belatedly to terms with its past, though also pointing out that other countries in Central Europe are unfortunately going in the opposite direction.
Terry, thank you very much indeed. That was the political journalist and author Terry Stiastny, and this is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Well, up next, we turn our attention to Lori, a folk festival celebrating the end of the winter solstice that will be enjoyed across the Indian subcontinent today. The festivities include bonfires, dancing, and a huge focus on food. To find out more about the event and its important culinary traditions, Monocle's Charlie Filmer-Court recently caught up with Chet Sharma, chef patron of Indian restaurant Bibi in London.
So Lori is the mark of the winter solstice. It's the beginning of the longer days of the year now. So it really marks the beginning of that transition from you know, the dead of winter through to brighter, longer days. And it's also, in a big way, it's part of what we kind of call the harvest festival in India as well. So it coincides with the first crop of sugarcane, of mustard greens, radishes, lots of the sort of winter produce from the north of the country.
And how is it typically celebrated? What would a normal day look like?
So it's normally marked by a big, it depends in the village if there's been a celebration. So whether that's a wedding, a recent wedding, a birth, anything like that, you typically celebrate big life occasions on Lori. So the way to mark it is generally to hold a big party with a big bonfire. And the idea is that the person who's, I guess, being honoured in it would walk around the bonfire. I mean, it's a very pagan ritual. Definitely goes back way before Sikhism, Islam, and Hinduism, which is why it's celebrated by all religions in the north of India, especially in Punjab. And yeah, it's kind of to mark or to request from the sun god that you get good weather and good heat for the rest of the year.
And there are obviously links to the harvest there, and you're a chef. So how important is food in the festival?
Oh, it's super important. So, I mean, it's definitely, Punjab is the agricultural hub of India. You know, 90%, 85% of the state's economy is based around agriculture. Both of my grandmothers, who my restaurant Bibi is named after, they both grew up in farming communities in Punjab, which is very, very common. So it's all about farming and produce. So the celebration is definitely marked with some very, very specific foods.
Could you maybe tell us about some of those specific foods? What are the main dishes that might feature on a Lori festival meal?
Well, so Lori, the word comes from Thil Lori, and Thil is sesame seeds. And then Lori is obviously the festival name. So sesame seeds are a big part of it. So the sesame harvest is, again, a big marker of when Lori sits. It generally sits around the 13th of January. But of course, it's based on a lunar calendar rather than solar. So it does actually change every year, but most people mark it on the 13th. So sesame seeds, big part of it. Like I said, mustard greens. So you'd have things like sarsal asag, which is essentially stewed mustard greens. That's often served, I guess, slightly less traditionally, because it's only been there for a few hundred years, but with makiri roti, which is a flatbread made with maize, with corn. Radishes you always eat because it's the radish season. Generally ground nuts, so peanuts and the things in that family, and then lots and lots of jaggery because of the sugarcane harvest as well.
And from a personal standpoint, what's your favourite of the traditional lorry dishes?
I mean, I'm a Punjabi guy, so I think I'd be excommunicated if I didn't say it was saag with makiri roti. In fact, I think my dad would start speaking to me, so I have to say that as well.
And how will you be celebrating it? Well, obviously, you might be partaking in that, but have you got any plans?
Such is the life of a chef, I'll be at whack. And we will be putting some special bits on the menu. I mean, we change our menu very, very regularly. We print it daily, so we have the flexibility to change things. So on Thursday itself, we'll have a couple of bits rolled up our sleeve, ready to go for that as well.
Can you give us any clues as to what they might be?
They're still in development. This is the exciting part of it. So we're still working on things. I mean, the restaurant, BB, is very much about taking those very inherently Indian flavors and taking some of these stories, but kind of whittling it down and refining it into something that fits a little better into our surroundings. So we will definitely do something with mustard greens for sure. But instead of being the traditional, you know, large portion with heaps and heaps of butter, I mean, it's sort of 50% butter to mustard greens, to why it's so delicious. But we'll do something like a little croquette. So it basically will make the mustard puree and then fill it into a shell and then sort of roll it in cornmeal and then deep fry it. So you still get all of those flavor notes just in a smaller bite, in a more manageable size. And we'll definitely do something with sesame seeds, but we're still debating that at the moment. We've got actually got a sesame seed ice cream being churned right now upstairs in the restaurant. So definitely we'll have some nice bits and pieces to mark Lorry, because it is such a big day for us.
And that was Monocle's Charlie Filmer-Court recently talking to Chet Sharma, chef patron of the Indian restaurant BB in London. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Finally, on today's programme, we're going to get a roundup of stories making the news in the world of theatre. And I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Matt Wolfe, who's the theatre critic of the International New York Times. Many thanks for coming in, Matt.
It's a great pleasure.
I think if we start with COVID, because, of course,
that's the story.
Yeah.
The question now in theater is, will the show go on? It's not so much what is the show, it's will there be a show? Particularly over Christmas, New Year, there were any number of scenarios of people arriving in town to see whatever, and it wasn't playing. Or there would be, you know, some much heralded new revival of Cabaret, for instance, terrific production with Eddie Redmayne and Jesse Buckley, and within days of it opening, it was shutting down again. This is because of COVID, not necessarily amongst the cast, but amongst the crews, stagehands, dressers. You know, it takes a lot of people to put on a show. So fair enough, everyone's being quite strict. But we seem, knock wood, to have got over that hump, and shows now seem to be back in action, thank heavens.
And is that both sides of the Atlantic?
It's been worse on Broadway, I have to say. On Broadway, there have been many a scenario where people arrive and are actually in their seats, and somebody comes on stage and says, no show tonight. I haven't heard that happening here.
Quite extraordinary, isn't it? How are people surviving then?
Well, it's very, very hard. I mean, Sonia Friedman, the West End and Broadway producer, gave an amazing interview the other day to the Sunday Times UK, where she talked about losing millions and millions of pounds just over the holiday period alone. I think it really is testing the tenacity of everyone who works in the theatre and also the people like the audience who support it.
Mm. So if we are willing to take the risk and go into a crowded theatre, and provided the show is on, what should we be seeing?
Well, I very much like Life of Pi, which is an adaptation of course, the Jan Martel novel from 2001, which a lot of people know better from the Ang Lee film, for which he won an Oscar. But it's rather extraordinary to see this tale of the title character Pi, who's a zookeeper's son, who's sort of cast adrift at sea with a 450-pound Royal Bengal tiger for company on a sort of lifeboat. And eventually he makes it to Mexico. And you think, this shouldn't work on stage. stage, but for some reason, because of Max Webster's direction, Tim Hatley's design, Finn Caldwell's amazing puppetry, it has its own theatrical energy. And actually, at the performance I went to, I was seated next to Jan Martel, the writer of the novel, and he very touchingly said after that there was something about seeing it on stage that for him was more moving than seeing it on screen because of the imaginative leap that's required.
Mm. And if people are interested in the original book by Jan Martel, just go into our archives because we have an interview there with him on Meet the Writers. Now, what about Oklahoma?
Well, Oklahoma, there's a whole raft of interesting shows coming up. And Oklahoma is the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, of course, but very well known both sides of the Atlantic. But this is a new version of it that radicalized New York in 2019, where I saw it. It won the Tony Award for Best Revival of a Musical. It was known in the biz in New York as Woklahoma because it's very out there. It's quite bold. It's quite brusque. And what it does is kind of wipe away any cobwebs that you might associate with kind of Rodgers and Hammerstein being perhaps a bit parochial or a bit twee or a bit dated. And actually it reminds you or reminds the audience that it's a show about the formation of America. And what was America founded on, amongst other things, principles of violence.
Yeah.
So you're really aware of the savagery that underpins what seems to be a very lyrical piece. And it was incredibly exciting in New York, and I hope it will be here.
So Helen Hanf, who wrote that book, 84
Charing Cross Road, yeah.
Was a publicist on Oklahoma when it very first opened, mm-hmm. Many, many years ago. And they were trying to publicize it and they just weren't getting much take up. And then they put an exclamation mark after Oklahoma and suddenly it sold.
Which
I think is extraordinary.
The musical theater is a very strange bistro, Gina. There's a story about the original Gypsy, the musical, where nothing was happening at the very end, and they put Ethel Merman in a red dress, everything was transformed.
Extraordinary. Now, Carol Churchill, whom I love, Girls on Top and all sorts of other wonderful, Top Girls, plays.
Yes.
She's got a show on a number at the Old Vic.
Well, I love Carol Churchill. She's in her 80s now, and I think it's fair to say, with all great respect to Tom Stoppard and Alan Bennett and others, that Carol Churchill is our greatest living English dramatist. But she would probably hate that accolade. She hates publicity. She doesn't want any attention. She just wants to go about her business. A Number is, I think, a masterpiece. It's a play that was first seen, hard to believe, 20 years ago at the Royal Court with Daniel Craig, pre-James Bond, and the wonderful Michael Gambon. And it's a two-hander, but it actually has in it four characters because it's a father and his three sons, all of whom are played by the same actor. This production is coming to the Old Vic by Waterloo. It's a new production, and it has two fantastic actors, Lenny James, back from Hollywood, where he's been living for a while, to play Salter, the father, and the amazing young actor, Papa Essidieu, as the three sons. And it's described as kind of a story about genetic cloning, but I think that's actually very reductive. I think it's much more about kind of the mysteries of the human experience, which is really Carol Churchill's ongoing topic, and I can't wait to see it.
One huge play that deals, of course, with the mysteries of the human experience is that play that I'm going to have to touch wood to say the title of, and that's Macbeth.
Macbeth?
Which is, I believe, that there are big plans to bring that back here to Britain. But let's talk about another Shakespeare, which of course is Henry V.
Well, there is a Macbeth coming to Broadway, by the way, with Daniel Craig. So that would be interesting if Broadway gets back in gear. Meanwhile, there was a Macbeth here at the Almeida. The Almeida has The Chairs coming up by Ionesco, and at the Donmar, Kit Harington, who everyone remembers fondly from Game of Thrones, is going to play the title role in Henry V. And I think this is great because, you know, here's a young actor who began in the theater. He's found fame and fortune on television, and he doesn't have to come to the Donmar to work for pennies, but he's doing it because he loves it, and he wants to be reminded of his theatrical roots, and that should be very exciting. I think it should also probably be quite a tough ticket. But it'll be interesting to see him play this kind of warrior king.
Matt, thank you very much indeed.
That a pleasure.
Was Matt Wolff, theatre critic of the International New York Times. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Rhys James, Paige Reynolds and Charlie Filmer-Court. Our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. And our studio manager, Chris Ablakwa. Now, we leave you with the news that Ronnie Spector, the lead singer of the 1960s pop group The Ronettes, has died at the age of 78. So before we go, just a little blast of their top hit, Be My Baby.